to the second lecture of this PSY course, Many Body Entanglement and Tensor Networks. My name is Gifre. And I'm one of the faculty here at Perimeter. I'm in office 421. And you know, if you have questions, you can always come and ask questions. So I have to apologize, I wasn't here yesterday, but I checked the lecture online, the lecture that Dennis gave you, and it was perfect. So that was actually this one, lecture number 4. And today I'll start with the introduction, which is what I should have done yesterday. Number one, introduction. So what I want to do today is to just motivate the whole course and maybe get started with lecture, well, with preliminaries for lecture 2. But mostly I just want to tell you what we are going to see over the next 3 weeks. And so let me start with motivation. So let's start with the hover model. I'm going to write the Hamiltonian here. This is the Hamiltonian, and the first thing I want to tell you is that we won't be able to solve this Hamiltonian, but I want to talk a little bit about it, try to see why we cannot solve it, and you know, see how far we can go solving similar problems. So what does this Hamiltonian stand for? What we have is a square lattice, and on the sides of the square lattice, on each side, we have some vector space, some Hilbert space, and it's going to be vector space C4. And that a basis for it would be having nothing on this side, having one electron with spin up, having an electron with a spin down, or having an electron spin up and spin down. Okay, so we have that our system is the tensor product of many sides, and on each side we have 4 options. And now this Hamiltonian, what it's telling us is, first we have some hopping term here, so some hopping amplitude. And what this is telling us is that if we had, say, spin up here, so a fermion with the spin up here, and there is nothing here, with some amplitude t, we may end up with having the fermion there. Similarly, we have some on-site potential or repulsion. And this is given by this amplitude u. And what it's telling us is that whenever we have 2 fermions on one side, one spin up and down, then there is some energy penalty for that, as given by u. Okay? And so this is a very simple Hamiltonian. It's a very simple model. It's known as the Hover model, and it was proposed in 1963. That's over 50 years ago. I wasn't born. Maybe your parents were very young. I don't know. It's long, long time ago. It's been really a long time. In this Hamiltonian, we see this competition between these two terms. If we only have one term, then the electrons are free to go around. So if we only had the hopping, they would organize as free fermions. We'll talk a lot about free fermions. You saw yesterday that we know how to deal with free fermions. If this term is not there and just this term is there, then we would have that the fermions try to organize, say, one on each side, or they try to separate. But they will be localized on the lattice. And the problem is when we put the two terms together, there is a competition between these two terms. And the ground state becomes much more involved. right? So our goal would be to understand what's the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And it turns out that the ground state becomes very involved. How involved? Well, we don't know, actually. So let me mention two things about this Hamiltonian. Then first, it's just a crude approximation. So comments. So it's a crude approximation. Okay. By what I mean is, what we want to model with that is electrons, which of course interact with each other on a periodic potential, say in two dimensions, right, on a square lattice. So this square lattice is given by the potential that is provided by some solid, the atoms in a solid. And these electrons are electrons shared by the different atoms, okay? So the idea here then is that, well, we replace this periodic potential, which is a continuum, with just allow, we replace that with a tight binding model where the electrons can be on one side or the next one, nothing in between, okay? That's a radical approximation, but let's accept it. And this is the hilarious part, right? You know, electrons can see each other with an interaction. The potential is a power law. So they can see each other at arbitrary distances. Well, we're just going to say, you know, it's enough to consider that they see each other when they are on the same side and nothing else. So these are, you know, radical approximations. I mean, one could think they are desperate approximations, but let's take them. And then, so the other comment is, well, we've made all these approximations. We wanted to model these electrons on a two-dimensional potential. We ended up with this simple Hamiltonian. And the other comment is that, well, it's unsolved. Okay? We don't know what the ground state is. It's been over 50 years, and we are still asking, what's the ground state of this simple Hamiltonian? And why do we care about this Hamiltonian? Well, as I said, this would be representing some material that is mainly two-dimensional. So there is another approximation, which is thinking that in a three-dimensional material, a real material can be actually effectively described by a two-dimensional gas of electrons on a periodic potential. So, you know, lots of approximations. We get to this very simple model, and we still don't know how to solve it. But the idea is that we think that this is related to high-temperature superconductivity. We think that maybe this Hamiltonian describes high-temperature superconductors. We think, but we don't know. So it's been unsolved, and that's not because we didn't try. So actually, I wasn't here. Yesterday, I was in New York in a meeting in a private foundation with a private foundation who wants to put a lot of money to try to solve this problem. Okay? Yeah. Good luck. Oh, this is being recorded. I keep forgetting. All right, I'll talk to the somebody can edit this part. We got the money, so. All right, so what can we do with that? Well, we could try exact diagonalization, techniques that people have tried, exact diagonalization. Now, what do we mean by this? Well, we're going to consider a small system instead of, maybe ideally we would like to deal with an infinite system, right, to get the thermodynamic properties, but let's be less, let's be happy with just a small system. How many sites can we consider if we build a whole Hamiltonian? Well, it's going to be on the order of 20 sites, right? The dimension of this Hilbert space scales as 4, the dimension of each site, to the n, right? So if you have, you know, very nice computer, maybe supercomputer, you can go to n sites. N sites is 4 times 5, right? That's not the thermodynamic limit. It's really very small. So, well, we have made some progress by studying 20 sites. Then we can try Monte Carlo sampling. So we cannot deal with all the possible configurations. There are too many. So let's try to sample. But there is a big problem. Monte Carlo sampling for this type of systems, fermions, has what's known as the sign problem, which basically means that as you sample different configurations, they give you results or contributions to the expectation value that you would like to compute with opposite sign, such that on average they cancel and you get a very, very small number, which is full of statistical, I mean, the errors are very high, very large. So you cannot use Monte Carlo, okay, quantum Monte Carlo for this problem. So, and then, well, I spent the whole day yesterday talking to people who've been trying for many years, say, density, dynamical mean field theory. I'm not going to write, I just want to say here that there are other techniques, variational wave functions. Etc. And there is no point in learning what I'm writing. I mean, maybe you don't see it, but it's okay, because everything failed. So let's focus on useful things instead. All right, so what's happening here? What's the big picture? This is not the only Hamiltonian we cannot solve. So let me tell you a couple of things about emergence. So this is a generic situation. We have some microscopic Hamiltonian. Maybe the Haber model, maybe something else. Other types of degrees of freedom, other types of interactions. Square lattice, cubic Kagome lattice. You know, there are many possibilities, but these are all Hamiltonians that can be written as sum of local terms on, say, 1D, 2D, 3D. And what we would like to extract from there is its ground state. And I say ground state as an example of object that involve all the degrees of freedom at once. So it could be a thermal state, it could be other things. But let's take the ground state as a representative of what we would like to do. So in particular, we would like to see how by means of this simple microscopic Hamiltonian that tells us how the microscopic degrees of freedom interact in a simple way, we'd like to see how this leads to some collective organization. So I'm going to call this, well, collective organization. To give rise to interesting collective phenomena such, well, it could be the system could behave as an insulator, or it could be a metal, or maybe it would be a superconductor. Maybe it could be a superfluid. And there are more supers, but I think that's enough. I mean, there is super solid, and then you add whatever you want. But another type of interesting orders, topological order. Maybe it gives rise to quantum criticality at zero temperature, and so on. Okay, so this what all these phenomena have in common is that if you get the same Hamiltonian but apply to say four or five sites, you won't see any of this. Okay, you need a large number of them. So what do we say here? We're saying the microscopic behavior is different. So this will be for n, the number of, did I mention n somewhere? N is the number of sites or particles, n on the order of 1, 2, 3, okay, small number of particles. The way they behave is very different from collective behavior. And here we're saying n much larger than 1, and by this, well, we would have to quantify. It really depends on the case, but we're thinking about hundreds, maybe thousands of sites. Okay, so there are, roughly speaking, two attitudes towards this. Remember that the problem is that the dimension of the Hilbert space for n particles, so the Hilbert space for n particles is typically, you take the Hilbert space for one particle, and you tensor product it. Maybe these are particles, maybe these are sites on a lattice. But the idea is you have to take the tensor product n times, right? Such a way that the dimension of this is equal to the dimension of the vector space for one site, say, to the nth power, right? So it's exponential, right? This goes exponentially in n. And once you have something that grows exponentially in n, if your computational resources are attached to this, if your cost grows exponentially with n, it means that sooner or later you hit a wall, and it doesn't matter whether you have access to the best computers, you won't be able to do much. For instance, 20 sites for the Haber model. All right, so there have been historically two attitudes towards that. So on the one hand, we have people who have decided that that actually, starting from the Hamiltonian, it might be that it's impossible, as a matter of principle, to compute the ground state. Might be impossible. It's not a computational issue. I mean, it's a philosophical one. It says for sufficiently large n, computers won't be able to do it. But on top of that, we lose some kind of logical connection here. It's as I try very hard, I fail, I declare that it's impossible. That's the attitude, right? We tried, generations of physicists tried to do something, they fail. Let's get to the nice conclusion that we fail not because we are not good, but because it cannot be done. And supporters of this point of view, and again, I just forgot this is recorded, are Nobel Prizes like Anderson and Loveling. Okay, so this is an important, I mean, it's been supported by very serious people who have made amazing contributions to condensed matter. The other attitude is to say, well, no, actually, we can get the ground state. If you give me the Hamiltonian, we can get the ground state. We may not know yet how, but we will get there someday. And actually, this course, the whole course is about telling you about progress that we've made in the last, over the last 10 years on this problem, on how to get closer to finding a solution, given a Hamiltonian, finding the ground state, okay? And we still don't know how to solve the Haber model, but we think that we are closer and closer to, we've been able to solve many Hamiltonians that in the past have been thought not to be solved or solvable. We don't know if there are cases where, indeed, there is something happening with nature that they give you the microscopic description and you cannot obtain the collective organization of the system. Maybe there is something, maybe we have to use the concept of emergence, strong emergence in some situations. But what we're trying to do here, instead of having a philosophical discussion about it, is we're trying to derive new strategies to find ground states. And so this course is going to be about discussing progress, recent progress. I'm saying over the last 10 years, that sounds like a lot of time, but actually most of the progress has been made over the last maybe 4 or 5 years, and it's ongoing. All right, so how are we going to go about this? So the first, this week, so I've divided the course into three parts. The first one is many-body computational challenge. It's about going in more detail through this. And I thought it was a good idea to mix in some more practical interaction with many-body systems. We won't go to a lab, but we'll do it with a computer. I want you to experience the pain of what exponential cost is. I see somebody laughing. Maybe they've gone through that before. Yeah, it is painful. So it will be even more painful for you. So what do I want to say about that? Today is the introduction. Tomorrow and the day after, we'll have MATLAB sessions the whole day, trying to understand how we would deal with these systems. And I insist here we'll have a cost. For instance, the first class. Tomorrow we'll see that the cost for we'll have that the dimension of our Hilbert space is going to be the smallest possible for one side. It's going to be 2. Okay, so we'll deal with spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. On each side we can have a spin up or down. That's it. So the local dimension is 2, and we'll see tomorrow that with a cost which is 2 to the 3 n, we can actually diagonalize a big Hamiltonian and get some results. And we'll also see that that we can do a bit better 2 to the 2 n. Okay, that's going to be tomorrow. And then the day after, I'll teach you a trick which will bring us to 2 to the n. Okay, so we're improving, but it's still exponential. So by the second session of MATLAB, you'll have gone from dealing with some number of sites to being able to deal with the same resources with 3 times that number. Okay, so if by the end of the first part we can deal with say 10 spins, by the end of the second lesson, MATLAB lesson, we can deal with 30 spins, which is, you know, it's better. All right, and then the idea would be to use this. This is a warm up for the second and third weeks. We want to have some tool so that we can deal with many body systems, even if they are small. Okay, we want to be able to study entanglement. We want to be able to understand that some structure of ground states, which will be the key later on to an efficient simulation. But we will have to cheat a little bit, because with 30 spins you cannot get very far. So another name for lecture, the lecture that you had yesterday, is, you know, the big cheat or something like this. We'll use the free fermion formalism. Now, free fermion formalism, this is for very specific type of system. Okay, this is not a generic system. You cannot use free fermions to solve the Haber model, but it has a cost which is only order n to the third power, right? So it's not exponential in n, it's just a power of n. And this will allow us to analyze large systems. And this will be our, you know, it's again, don't think of this as, oh, there is no many body problem, we can do everything. No, this is really just free particles. But it will allow us to get some insight. We'll be able to study large systems. We'll be able to use it as a tool to explore many body entanglement. Okay, so that would be the first week. Then the second week is entanglement in many body ground states. So we will just use these tools to explore the structure of entanglement in many body states, many body ground states. And then in the third week, we'll use what we've learned during the second week to understand how we can actually efficiently simulate ground states of many body systems. Okay, so this is a formalism that generically will bring all the computational cost to order n. Okay, so we can study very large systems generically, except that there will be some prefactor here. So it's proportional to n. If you double your system size, you just need to double your computational resources to study it. But there is a prefactor that has to do with how much entanglement we have in the system that is still, you know, we still have to work hard. I mean, this is what we are doing nowadays in research, right? So it's an open question how well we can use these methods. But I'll tell you more about that. So then let me summarize all this by saying then that in part one, so you'll learn exact diagonalization. You'll learn the free fermion formalism. And I insist, and I'll keep saying that we're cheating here. Then this will be our tools. Okay, we're just acquiring some tools. And then in part two, we'll learn about the structure of ground states. By this I mean we'll learn about their entanglement. So we'll learn that by applying these tools. And then once we've learned about that, we'll exploit. Once we've learned about this structure of ground states, we'll use it to we'll exploit it to create new tools. And that's part three. So tensor networks. Okay, so we'll exploit it to create new tools. And this was the original motivation. We wanted to have tools to attack these problems. But it turns out that in the process, we've learned that we don't have just some numerical strategies, but we have a whole formalism that has become now the standard to describe many body wave functions, which is used also for discussions, analytical, to write theorems, to make progress in many body physics. So nowadays, tensor networks are not just some computational approach. They are the basis. They offer a formalism in which to phrase questions about many body physics. And for instance, one of the things that has been accomplished over the last 2 years is the classification of possible phases of matter, not by running tensor networks, but actually by writing the ground state as a tensor network and then discussing what type of such tensor networks we could have. Okay? So it's a tool, but it's also formalism, theoretical formalism. But as a tool, what I'm saying is here we were stuck with exponential of n, and here now we have order n. Okay, so this is very significant progress. So as I said before, now we're trying to apply these techniques to finally solve the Haber model. And we will see how far we can get. All right. So MATLAB, why, let me see, we're fine. Have 15 more minutes. So as you could see from, are there any questions so far? Okay, so as you could see from the structure of the course, we'll have several sessions of MATLAB, 5 in total. I would say don't be scared of MATLAB. You know, I'm glad to see that so many people have decided to take the class. If this was a computational class, then we would be using MATLAB on part 3, but we're not going to touch this. We're going to only discuss this theoretically. Okay, I want you to get the big ideas that led to this formalism. But I included some lectures. Last year I taught this class. There was no computation at all. I thought it would be very useful for you. Those of you who already know MATLAB, you know, enjoy. It's going to be easy. Those of you who are not familiar with MATLAB, this is your chance to just get, you know, we're going to use it in very simple context, but it's going to add a tool to what, you know, to your set of tools. So I think that computational skills, acquiring some computational skills is not a commitment to just using the computer from that moment on. It's just an extra tool that you can have. So let's see. So at this point, I would like to ask you, have you downloaded MATLAB already in your laptops? Can you raise your hand if you have? Okay, somebody didn't raise the hand.
So how many of you did not manage to download?
Well, I wanted to ask this, but. Okay, who didn't download MATLAB? Who's taking the class and didn't download MATLAB? You still have time? I mean, that's nobody answer, okay? So I'm talking to myself, but you still have time. We'll start using it tomorrow. Even if you're not taking the class, just download it, come tomorrow, give it a try. I mean, it should be easy, it should be fun, and you'll learn something that it's later on. You know, this is knowledge that you don't have to apply to many body physics. You can apply it to anything else you want, okay? So, but if you come tomorrow and you have not downloaded MATLAB, then you're going to waste your time. All right. Did anybody have a problem? Did you try MATLAB already? Did you see that it works? This is the first time that, I mean, we had to call MATLAB and ask for licenses and everything. So it's an experiment. So make sure that it works. Let's not start a session tomorrow and find out that it's not working. All right, so another, still 15 minutes. Well, that's amazing. So, what happened here?
You have half an hour left.
Sorry?
The clock is 10 minutes fast.
Still have half an hour.
Oh, that's great. I have material. All right, so 1.5 was about MATLAB. 1.6, why should you take this course? Well, what I'm going to do here is to tell you a bit, again, the big picture, as if I was trying to convince you to take it. But the first thing is we're going to learn some important stuff. So why is this important? So far, or for many years, we've dealt with many body physics or quantum field, even quantum field theory. When they tell you we're going to learn quantum field theory, you should really pay more attention. They're telling you we're going to learn quantum field theory for free particles, and then we'll do some perturbation around it, right? So when they start telling you about Feynman diagrams, this is not a generic situation where you can apply perturbation theory. This is just the result of, well, this is the best we can do, right? So typically, for many years, we focused on Hamiltonians. We have one that we can solve, H0. Then we add some perturbation, and then we do perturbation theory. So quantum field theory is an example of that, where we mostly are talking about perturbative expansions or perturbative approaches. And it's focused on operators, the Heisenberg picture, right? You study how operators evolve in time, perturbatively, and so on. So what we have here, what we are discussing in this course is a change of attitude, a change of paradigm. For the first time, we look at the wave function. We used to think, oh, this wave function lives in a huge Hilbert space. We're not going to be able to deal with it. But no, now we think that maybe we can deal with it. And there are already many cases where we can deal with the whole wave function, even though it lives in this huge Hilbert space. And so this is, in contrast to typical approaches, this is non-perturbative. We don't care whether there is an exact solution nearby. Okay, we only care about being able to, well, about things like entanglement, and I'll describe what that means during the mostly second and third week. And it's focused on the wave function. Okay, so it really, we're changing attitudes. And so this course is about introducing you to this new attitude. And then I also want to mention that this is a young and very active field of research. So things are happening now. There is no book. I had to write these notes. There is no book where you can find all this yet. And it's very active. It's evolving, and it's a research area which is highly interdisciplinary in the sense that we have condensed matter. So in the end, condensed matter is a natural. It's the natural target here. But the ideas that we are using started in quantum information. I started my career working in quantum information. And then it mixes, of course, it has a strong component of computational physics, computational physics. Okay, so these are the three main components, condensed matter, quantum information. So this started with ideas from quantum information into condensed matter. And then there has been a lot of back and forth between these three research areas. Now, nowadays, these tensor networks have gone beyond this origin, where the fields where they started. And they can be used in the context of statistical physics or mechanics. They are also used in computer science. So nowadays, people take these ideas that we've developed for quantum many-body physics, and they just go straight, and they try to apply it to classical problems as well in computer science. But even it got a bit crazy. Even string theorists got an interest. String theory. Some of the tensor networks that were proposed now they are being used to discuss ADS-CFT, the ADS the holographic principle, and also quantum chemistry. Okay, so I want to give you the impression, or I want you to know that this is not a very narrow field of research, that this is having implications in many different areas. So the meeting I was in yesterday, there were a number of quantum chemists as well. All right, enough selling. And now I just need to organize this. One. So another, I don't know, I'm confused. 10, 15, 25 minutes, sure. So let's start with lecture two. Let's start introducing the formalism that we'll be using tomorrow with MATLAB, but of course without MATLAB, okay? Sorry, any questions before that? So this is the introduction to the whole 3 weeks. Are there questions? Excellent. Let's start with quantum spin chains. So I know that you've seen already, or you had several courses, or I think more than one at least, that dealt with the quantumizing model. And this is great because this means that I'm just reviewing something that you know of. So let me just write the Hamiltonian. So what we're going to do is we're going to use the quantumizing model as a prototype for a problem that we would like to solve. And I know that we can solve it in many different ways. I know that we can use analytical tools to solve it. But I'm going to ignore that. And I'm going to try to do it with exact diagonalization. And then the advantage of this, of using exact diagonalization, is that you can use it for any problem that you want. So we'll use it in the particular context of the quantumizing model, but knowing that the tool that we're developing is for generic Hamiltonians. And then we can use the fact that we also know how to solve the Ising model exactly as a way of checking whether the computation is giving you the right answer. All right, so what's the Hamiltonian? This is going to be where we have a one-dimensional lattice with n sides. And we'll have two terms there. I'm going to assume periodic boundary conditions, so when I is equal to n, I plus 1, it's n plus 1 means side 1. And what do we want to say about this Hamiltonian? Well, the first thing is that there is a symmetry. It has a symmetry. So if this is the x, y, and z axis, we realize that if we take z to z, x to minus x, and y to minus y. So basically what we're doing is a rotation by 180 degrees. Okay. Then this will be a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So that we can define some unitary unitary transformation just given by the product of sigma z's on all the sides. And then you can check that if you take the Hamiltonian and you conjugate it by this unitary transformation, you get your Hamiltonian back. Okay, and I think you've seen this. If not, or if you don't remember, the observation is that this term here, you know, z goes into z, so sigma z goes into sigma z. Every single sigma z goes into sigma z, whereas sigma x goes into minus sigma x. Now you have a minus sign here, but there are two sigma x's, so the Hamiltonian stays the same. Okay? So then we can introduce some, is that the last blackboard? So what else do we need to review? We have an order parameter. If we take m, mx, we're going to define this as the expectation value of, or the average of the expectation value of sigma x on all the sides. Okay. So by symmetry, this we would expect it to be 0, right? Because sigma x, under symmetry, sigma x is mapped into minus sigma x. So the only way to have this as an expectation value is if it's 0. But in practice, we'll find that this takes two possible values, 0, if we are in a symmetric phase. Okay, so we'll take the expectation value on the ground state. And it will be different from 0 if we are in a spontaneous, if we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. All right? So as part of this quick review, I'm going to talk then about the phase diagram. So we could draw a line. Here we have, let's say, what is this? H over J. Okay. We have 0, we have infinite. And then what we say is, let's suppose first, so let's suppose first that J is much larger than H, right? So the first term in the Hamiltonian dominates over the second. In this case, you can, or you've seen what the ground state looks like. So the Hamiltonian reduces basically to this. And there are two ground states. One is all the spins with a plus state, and the other one is all the spins with a minus. Okay, so there are two ground states with magnetization being plus or minus 1. So that's the case where we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. So we're talking about J much larger than H, so H over J is, we're here. We're right here. Okay, and what we're saying is that here we have mx equal to plus or minus 1. So this is spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay? The other case is when j is much smaller than h, when the coupling is the interaction, so to say, is much larger than the magnetic field, then the Hamiltonian reduces to just the magnetic field, effectively. And in this case, we have a unique ground state, which is all the spins in state 0 or pointing in this in up direction. And so the magnetization in this case is 0. So we're talking about this point. Here we have magnetization is zero, right? So we have a symmetric state. And so what we want to do tomorrow is to actually fill the gaps. Okay? We have been able to solve exactly this point and this point. You can check that these are the ground states. What we would like is to see what the magnetization is doing, and you've seen this many times, so we'll be doing something like this. There are two values, and somewhere we'll see what happens in the middle region, but somewhere it becomes zero. Okay? So I think you've seen, all of you have seen this before. Perfect. So I need one more blackboard. Is that one? So I have 10 more minutes. So let me go to 2.2. Let's discuss the tensor product before we have the computer in front of us. So remember that the laws of quantum mechanics are clear. There is a postulate that says if you have two quantum systems, the Hilbert space is the tensor product of two, or of the two Hilbert spaces for individual systems. So if we had, say, the Hilbert space for systems A and B together is Hilbert space for A times the Hilbert space for B, right? Tensor product. And what we want to do tomorrow is actually to get our hands dirty with that. How to, we want to put this in our computer. So what we want to do is we want to take the Hamiltonian for the Ising model for n sites, where n is going to be maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And we want to build a big matrix for this Hamiltonian. Okay, so if we had n equal to 1, then we care about sigma x, which we'll use it to be like that, and sigma z, which we use it to be this matrix, and then, of course, also the identity. These are the building blocks that we will have. If we wanted to study two systems, then the relevant matrices are going to be products of those. For instance, let's try to build the magnetic field. Magnetic field on the first side looks like that. And we really need to, you know, this is a review again, but we need to get used to this because we'll be implementing it. So how does this look like? Well, first I write it as in terms of the expressions for the two operators. Okay? And now I try to write this as a big matrix. So what's the trick here? Remember that what we are going to do is we're going to copy the second matrix four times. 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I would have to write it like this. So I copy the identity four times. And now I look at the coefficients in front of the first matrix, and I use them to multiply this. So each block, right? So one times identity, zero times the identity, zero times identity, and here is a minus one times identity. So after that, I can replace all the zeros. We have all these zeros, right? And here we have identity, and here we have minus the identity. Did I do something wrong here? I think that's correct. Okay. So that's how you compute it, right? So similarly, now we could take identity times sigma z, and, well, by now you know how it works. So I would have to copy this four times, but I already see that there are zeros here. So I'm just going to copy it here and here. I'm not going to bother with the zeros. And then I say 1 times sigma z, and here 1 times sigma z. Fine. So this is what I want. And the rest zeros everywhere else. Okay?
In this convention, what are the basis states?
Basis states.
Like is it up, up, and then up, down?
Oh, okay, good question. So let's see, for one site, I have 0 and 1, right? And I should have said that. So what do I mean by 0 all the time? Well, this is an eigenstate of sigma z, such that you get back 0. So if you want, this is the state 1, 0. And the 1, sigma z, is equal to minus 1. And this is, sorry, that's dangerous. Okay. So we have this. Okay. So this is what I call 0 and 1. And the 0 in matrix form is this guy. And the 1 in matrix form is this guy. Okay. And so if I use this all together, we get the sigma z is 1, 0, 0, minus 1. Okay. Now, once we have these bases, how do we take the tensor product of such bases? Well, we'll have the state 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and 1, 1. Right? And this 0, 0 is nothing but this one. And then you expand it, and you get this. And the rest, you know, exercise, right? Is that clear? That should fix the notation for the whole 3 weeks. Okay. All right. So to be sure that this is clear, let's use the rest of the time to look at how sigma x times sigma x would look like. Okay? So in this case, we use this to know that we have to put 4 copies of that, of this one, right? But on the diagonal, we can put zeros already, 0 and 0. And on the off diagonal, we have this. Fine. So see, we have built 3 matrices now. We have built sigma x, sigma x. We have built z identity, identity z. That's enough to now have the Hamiltonian for this Hamiltonian for 2, for n equal to 2. Okay, these are the matrices that you will have to input to build a Hamiltonian. So, but in general, we will want to have n sides, right? So that was n equal to 2. Now, if we go to n sides, and I'll take an example, n equal to 4, then let's write the Hamiltonian explicitly. So in this case, we have minus j, and then we have sigma x, identity, identity. I'm not going to write the tensor product. The tensor product is here all the time, right? So I'll write it in yellow once, and then I stop. Okay? So we have this term. We have this term. We have also to build this term. Okay. And depending on what type of boundary conditions, we'll have to include an interaction between the first and last spin. So this is only for periodic boundary conditions. I'm assuming then it's clear how to build these matrices, right? Just iterate what we have explained 4 times. We've explained it for 2 matrices, so you just iterate that and you get, sorry, we explain it explicitly for 2 spins. We've seen it explicitly for 2 spins, for 4 spins. You just keep doing the same at identities or sigma x's. Then there will be the other term, which would be sigma z, identity, 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 sigma z, identity, identity, plus identity, identity, sigma z, identity, and the last one. Okay. So if we want to put our Hamiltonian into the computer, we have to write something like this. Okay, we have to create every single matrix. That's this matrix here. Let's take any of these matrices, say this one, or if you want the Hamiltonian. Now it's a 2 to the 4 times 2 to the 4 matrix. Okay, so 16. This is a huge matrix with 16 times 16 entries. Okay? Perfect. Any questions about that? All right, so I'll keep going. I don't know where, but I'll keep going. So then, over the 3 weeks, we'll see that we have to deal with objects, tensors that have many indices. And we will often resort to some graphical notation. And so if I want to express the wave function, say the ground state, as a sum of, so I can always expand it in a local basis, a, j, k, l. This is a basis for each of the spins. So a, I, j, k, and l go from 0 to 1, okay? Each side can be in state 0 or 1. This is a basis. There are 16 options here, 16 configurations of basis elements. So 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, etc. Now we have some coefficients here, psi, I, j, k, l. You see we have an object here, which is a tensor with 4 indices. Okay? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start using some diagrammatical notation where this represents psi, this object, and each leg represents an index. Okay? So for instance, if we want to take our state and multiply it by sigma x on side 3, okay, so I'll draw this as this is the state with 4 legs, and I'll go to the third leg and I'll multiply it by a matrix. So what's the idea here? If you see a circle, this is a complex number. If you see a circle with 1 leg, this stands for some vector with 1 index, alpha. If you see a circle with 2 legs, this stands for some matrix, alpha, beta. Okay? So every time you see something, an object with a number of legs, say 3, this is some tensor with alpha, beta, gamma, with 3 indices and so on. And so this circle here is a matrix. And what matrix is it? Well, it's precisely this one here.
What's the convention for the ordering of the legs?
It's a bit loose. Okay. Somebody should specify it to you. But it will be clear from the context.
Should there be like some consistency rule when I change of basis or the diagrammatic notation?
A change of basis, you mean a local rotation?
Or something like that.
So it just comes naturally. You'll see that what we are doing is we are replacing indices with legs. If you've made a change of basis, it will come with, you will have multiplied by a unitary transformation. So it will be clear from the context. Okay. Perfect. So now I'm going to stop because I really ran out of material. But I think it's time. Oh, it's perfect. So tomorrow, please come with MATLAB ready. And we'll see how to take this Hamiltonian and put it into the computer and ask what's the ground state for up to 10 sites. Okay?